This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Gar Alperovitz and Ed Whitfield envision another system and work to create processes and institutional microcosms to bring it on. Yes, another world is possible. What must we do?
First, we hear from Gar Alperovitz, who develops a brilliant strategy for the type of transformative change that can lead America from decline to rebirth by creating an America beyond capitalism.
I want to give you just a bit of information on this project, which we call the Next System Project. But before doing it, the basic idea and recognition that came behind and before and in developing the project. And it is this, and particularly for a left forum, this is what we have at least discovered. The era of the Soviet communist threat is so far behind American historically behind American politics, we are finding that the traditional argument when I was young and in graduate school, and you can't talk about it, a different system from corporate capitalism, it's got to be a monster of Stalinism, simply isn't out there for any significant number anymore. Very important. Secondly, that very large numbers of people are aware that the system is in very profound trouble, not simply political problems. That, I mean, some of the data is obvious. That is, the top 400 people have more wealth now than the bottom 180 million taken together. I often give that number in lectures, and I say that's a medieval distribution of wealth, literally. Except a medieval historian came up to me afterward and said, it was never that bad. But people are aware of the problems in income distribution, climate change, gender relations, what's going on in the frontline communities. There is some change in consciousness, at least we think, and I think many other people are beginning to see this. And secondly, there are a lot of interesting experiments developing around the country that point towards something different. There are co-ops, worker co-ops developing. There are complex worker co-ops integrated with larger numbers of people and supported by public purchasing and community building. There are land trusts, several hundred around the country. In Boulder, Colorado, there was municipalization of the utility out of climate change concerns, socializing it. They're almost at the last stage of that. Mayors are now putting public money into the development of worker co-ops in this city and many other cities. There are 20 states that have had introduced single-payer health care. There are 20 states that have had legislation for a single public bank of the state, like the Bank of North Dakota. There are several cities, Santa Fe and Philadelphia are the most advanced. They're trying to set up city banks. They're using eminent domain, which is city socialization in Richmond, California, where they're using it as a way to deal with housing problems. So there is, and I could go on and on in different areas, there's a whole big climate change movement that is also moving towards institution change. And so one of the questions we've run into, and I suspect you have as well, is as this builds, where does it go? What are we talking? Are we talking about nice projects? Are we talking about building a politics? Or, as many people sense, if we're facing a systemic crisis of corporate capitalism, genuinely, and if that's available to many, many, many people, then what really is the alternative becomes an implicit question in the debate. Where do we go, and why would it be better, and how do you make sense, given that the one model that we know most about, state socialism or Stalinist communism, has so many faults on every front? It is a legitimate question to ask, what is the next system, and why would it be better, and what have you got to say about it? And if someone asks you, what are you talking about? Projects? Building politics? Or changing the system? And what we're beginning to find is that question is a legitimate question amongst far more people than anyone has hitherto thought, at least we certainly didn't think that. And we're finding people willing to begin discussing that. The poll data show, and I think probably people know this, that people under 30 slightly favor the word socialism now over capitalism. And racial minorities, the number goes up, and Hispanics goes up beyond that. So there is an openness to a different discussion, and it's a legitimate discussion. Many on the left have not engaged directly with the honest question of your neighbor. Well, if you don't like what we've got, what are you talking about? So the nature of the system project is an attempt to begin to open that debate amongst large numbers of people beyond the left, and also within the left, in a way that can be explained to Americans much broader than the groups we normally talk to. And so the first step in that was a statement released just about a month ago, signed by about 300 people. And what was interesting about the statement was many, many people on the left signed it. Let me give you some. Chomsky was one of the leading figures. Bill Fletcher, John Bellamy Foster, Michael Albert, Peter Marcuse, Bertel Ullman, Richard Smith, Richard Wolff, Richard McChesney, Daniel Ellsberg, but also people like Angela Blackwell, Dean Baker, liberals, Herman Daly, economists. The list goes on and on. Surprising, very strong left representation, but over in places that at least I was surprised, people would sign saying, we're facing a system problem. It's time to talk about a systemic alternative. Two of the surprises for me were Robert Reich, the former Secretary of Labor, well-known liberal, signed this statement, and Jeffrey Sachs signed this statement as well. Bill McKibben as well on this. So it's a very interesting grouping of people who at least signed on. And then when it was released, internet release of various forms, about 5,000 people immediately signed it, which really surprised us that there was that much quick response. So we're the sense of this is that it's time people are open to this discussion. And then the question is, what is the response we all make? And one of the things we've learned is that there are emerging positions, all of which have thoughtful people working on them, that actually are beginning to develop systemic designs. They start with a solidarity economy as a way of approaching the problem. There is a group that's, Rick Wolf, for instance, emphasizes worker-owned companies as a centerpiece. There are people who start at the ecological end, who are beginning to develop models that are essentially ecological and then move back to other issues of importance. There's a range of about a dozen models that are being proposed, which is critical and very important because it opens the way to an honest discourse where people can actually sort out, if you don't like this one, what are you talking about? Is it community building? Is it worker-owned building? Does it start at a different premise? Is there national planning? Is there planning? Is it markets? All the hard questions, including in the one I think is most important, and the left did not address, it certainly didn't address well, how does this system actually enhance liberty as well as democracy, as well as equality? So we're seeing a range of discussions like that that haven't been put on the map in time, and the notion is that it's time to open up explicitly, legitimate, and have a nationwide debate amongst not only the left, but reaching out to people who would not normally be in this debate. One, the premise is that we face a systemic crisis, not simply a political crisis. Most of the long decaying trends, income distribution, wealth distribution, climate change, imprisonment, et cetera, 30, 40 year trends, Democrats and Republicans were elected through those 30 years, and mostly the trends don't change. Exactly. That's a system problem, not just a political problem. But many people on the left understand this, but what we're learning is that a much, much broader group of people understand that. And therefore, the question is, what do you want becomes real and very important, I think, for the first time in modern American history, certainly since the beginning part of the 20th century, and Debs in that period when there was a socialist movement. So it becomes really important, we think, to address it intellectually, address it politically, address it in terms of building projects that should suggest new directions, and open up a much, much broader debate.
And we flow now seamlessly from Gar Alperovitz to Ed Whitfield. What is to be done? More and more people are disenfranchised from and feeling disenchanted with our economic system, with its long and steady trajectory, concentrating wealth and political power in the hands of a few, and which has created a monstrous apparatus of policing and prisons that are increasing exponentially. Meanwhile, Ed Whitfield, co-managing director of the Fund for Democratic Communities, who speaks and writes on issues of cooperatives and economic development, on issues of education and social responses to racism, and is active in the call by the Southern Grassroots Economies Project to develop a Southern Reparations Loan Fund, offers us a coherent vision of what building a new system might look like. You might say Gar Alperovitz and Ed Whitfield were double-teaming the plutocrats.
I want to talk, you know, directly to this question of next system as it relates to the things in the world that I care about, which is a lot of stuff. We live in a country. There's a historian that people should become more familiar with called named Gerald Horn, and he was talking about American exceptionalism. He said, you know, it really is. I mean, there's something to this idea of American exceptionalism, because here we live in a country that was founded on genocide and murder and enslaved people, and yet it carries itself out as a paradigm of virtue in the world. So that's pretty exceptional. So I want to talk about that as a context for thinking about what our next system needs to be as it relates to where we are now and where we have been. And in particular, I want to talk about, you know, something that the Democracy Collaborative and the Fund for Democratic Communities share, which is a concern for democracy and an interest in economics that goes pretty deeply. My contention is that the fundamental feature, the fundamental characteristic of a next system that will allow us to express our full humanity is that it would democratize wealth. That the whole notion of the democratization of wealth is at the essence of an understanding of what has in the past been wrong, what currently is wrong, and what needs to be corrected as we move into the future. Because this economy, we know by its heavy concentration of wealth and power, which speaks to a solution that has to do with a fundamental redistribution of wealth and power. Democracy is a question of power. Democracy is all about who has the power to make their will into fact in their interest. So for us to be fundamentally and deeply small-d democratic, that party that has stolen that word and using its name ought to be ashamed of itself. But for us to fundamentally be small-d democratic, we would have to be fundamentally in favor of shifting the power to implement the will of the vast majority, the common people, through a process that I want to claim to be at the essence and the core of democracy, of an expanded ability for us to think together and decide what it is we're going to do. Some people's notion of democracy stops at them having their will, and which is why it is that when you shift structures some places, nothing changes, because you just have another few people who are exerting their will. And the fundamental problem of how do we take people who are objectively different, have different experiences, have different capacities, have different passions, have different values, and well together out of that something that can do things together, is the fundamental kind of problem of democracy. How do we learn how to think together and come up with something that is actually in our interest and not in the interest of a few who would trample over everybody else to have their way? So the idea of democratizing wealth is one that puts the wealth of a society, the socially produced wealth that has been produced over the eons of time, making that available to people to meet human needs and elevate the quality of life, all right? One of the ways I like to express it, because I love metaphors and telling stories, is to talk about everything in the world today is made up of blood, bones, and dirt. Once upon a time, all there was a big wet ball of dirt floating out in space, spinning on its axis, floating with the sun shining on it. That's all that there was. That was all that we had. That was all that we needed. And while at one time that was all that we had, at one time we all had it. But now we don't. Because now the systems of ownership allow this big wet ball of dirt to be sliced up and owned in such a way that 80 people in the world own as much as half of the Earth's population combined. 80 folk. This is obscene. This isn't just wrong. This isn't just strange. It is obscene. And I think we should think of it that way. That this system of ownership just doesn't really make any sense. But at one time, all it was this big wet ball of dirt. Now there's something else. There are buildings, there are transportation systems, there are cities, there are universities, there's science and technology, there's computer software, there are computers, whether we can get them to work or not. There's all kind of other stuff. There's machinery, there are factories. There are all kinds of things that are capable of multiplying human labor's ability to work on this wet ball of dirt and provide for human needs so that only a few people now are required to produce the food that it takes for a family, at least for cities to live on for a year because of the level of something else. And I call those bones because to me that's nothing but dead labor. This is the living labor, that blood had acted on that ball of dirt and now is a pile of bones. And it is represented in the trillions of dollars of value that have been produced by labor and exist all around the world that are symbolically represented in financial houses that are centered in a few places, some places in the Far East, New York, Charlotte, North Carolina, of all places, where these financial centers are that have the symbolic representation of this value that is created. But all that value is, just to think of it as bones. Once this earth was in common, the ball of dirt, but now we not need to make a commons of the pile of bones and the ball of dirt, all right? So that living labor is able to make use not only of this earth. We were talking, I was in another workshop a few minutes ago talking about land and rent. And I just had to point out, I said, in the final analysis, land ownership is based on theft. Absolutely. Because no one made any. Anybody here know how to make land? I have yet to see a hand go up. No one created any land, so how does anyone get to own it? It's because they stole it from other people who had it in common and worked it. And this land theft is ongoing because they never quite completed it. Because there's a funny kind of relationship between land and labor, which is you can have a bunch of land and be of very little value to you unless you have some labor. So part of the conquest, part of the history of this country, the United States, is that as they were stealing land, they were kidnapping and stealing labor to work the land to make the land of value. And so going across the South, the Mississippi, the Mississippi Delta, some of the most fertile land on earth, they say it's land that you measure in tens of feet what is measured in other parts of the country in fractions of an inch in terms of rich topsoil. This was, you know what happens to a seed when it falls on very rich soil? It grows into a tree. So the Mississippi Delta we now know as this big flat farmland that people use for growing cotton was once virgin timber that was clear cut to produce those deltas. And then the clear cutting of it was done by slave labor, and it was done with the investment of Europe and the British Navy, the French Navy, all the European folks, Northern capital, all of it was involved. So the whole financial systems and structure that were rooted in cotton production were again part of the wealth that had been produced. So these bones that produce the entire modern financial world need to, just like that ball of dirt, be held in common so that we have democratized wealth. I mean, you know, so much of how we understand the world is caught up in narratives. So much of it is caught up in stories that people tell that help them to make sense of things. Who here would believe me if I told you, if I give you a sandwich, you will have something to eat for a day, but if I teach you how to make a roast beef sandwich, you could eat for a lifetime? Who would believe that? If I teach you how to make a roast beef sandwich, you could eat for a lifetime? No. Does anyone believe that? Well, why is it y'all used to believe that about fish? Do you know that fish story is a modern American blame the victim story, because in this country, where education is readily available, but where access to the means of production are not, to tell people that all you have to do is know how to fish and you should be able to feed yourself for a lifetime is to tell you that you have not availed yourself of the ability to learn how to fish, therefore you are hungry, as opposed to describing the fact of the matter is, which is if you don't have access to a fishing pole and a water hole, then you're not going to do it. So why is it that the fish story has such currency and you wouldn't have believed it about a roast beef sandwich, where you would know you needed some land to graze some cows on and some place to grow the grain that they were going to eat and some place to grow the grain that you can use to make the bread, and somehow you needed all the ingredients to make mayonnaise before it would be too dry to eat? Why is it that you wouldn't believe it? Because it's clear that fishing and water is the closest thing we have left to the commons. So somewhere deep in our recessed memory of how the world used to be was the hunting and gathering days of when fish and water were all in common, or all you needed to do was know how to hunt an antelope and you could get some meat on your table and gather some berries and you have something to eat. So we had been given a metaphor that was last true during the hunting and gathering period and use it as a way of understanding why it is that people are poor in this society. And I say that because it's important if we look to move into a different kind of economy, it has to democratize wealth, which is exactly the presumption under which the fish story would be true. That if indeed the wealth of our communities were democratically owned and democratically controlled, then knowing how to make use of it would be the requirement that would be required to meet human needs and elevate the quality of life. So my contention is that, again, this democratizing of wealth, and we can understand it this way, giving access of the means of production, which require transforming systems of ownership to have much more distributed ownership and much more democratic control, is the essence of what needs to happen. But I want to go back one more minute to another thing I mentioned, and then I'm going to drop this. The penal system having grown out of slavery. Not only did it grow out of slavery, it is where slavery maintains a legal existence in this country. Because the amendment abolishing slavery said except for the commission of a felony. So we have a legal slave system still functioning in the society. But more than that, let's think about slavery and reparations. There's a good deal of currency that discussions around reparations are getting. My contention is that we need to think of reparations from the standpoint of not figuring out how to do something to enhance consumption. Let's not figure out how to pass out some checks to some people that, quite frankly, in this consumer society we live in, people would take and spend. Which means that if I had been a slick white politician a long time ago, I would have said, all these folks talking about reparations, good idea. I would have doled out $100,000 to everybody I could pass it out to, realizing that within a couple of months or maybe a year, all that money would be spent and there'd be a big jump in the economy. That'd be my little stimulus packet. And then I would say it's over. Y'all got it. You had it. Forget it. You know. So no more discussion around reparations. No, they're not that smart. Please don't. I hope no one from here goes out and tells somebody. Somebody will run for president on that. I know what we can do. No. But think of it. 40 acres and a mule was not a consumption unit. It was a production unit. Russell Simmons, in his great wisdom, I don't know why I want to pick on him, but he's the one that said it. He said it ought to be, we ought to talk about 40 acres and a Bentley. No, Russell, a mule could grow its own food. A mule ends up producing enough to feed a mule and feed you and feed the people in the neighborhood area around you. So 40 acres and a mule is a unit of production. A Bentley had never produced any food for anybody, as best I could tell. And it takes away a lot. You know, it does not produce even the fuel that the Bentley runs on, let alone feeding the guy that's going to have to drive it. A mule could. So we're talking about production units. So to me, the idea of reparations needs to be caught up in taking some of this tremendous wealth that is available in this country and making it back again available to the people who have been part of how it was produced so that they can produce again democratically through democratic ownership and democratic control. And to me, that is around building cooperative economic structures that are inherently democratically owned and democratically controlled. So I want to see us shift the dialogue around reparations toward reparations for development in underserved communities So for that, concretely, one of the things we're working on right now with the Southern Grassroots Economies Project is something we're calling the Southern Reparations Loan Fund. Mm-hmm. That is rooted in the idea of being radically inclusive, which is to say making finance available to people who are not bankable, people who are not typically given access to borrowing even from the from this commonly produced wealth symbolic of all these bones, that you radically include people by offering the technical assistance to help people develop enterprises that can be profitable and sustainable, using access to this wealth that is available through democratic processes that are themselves decentralized. So the Southern Reparations Loan Fund is one of the instances where we're trying to make concrete this dialogue about reparations. To me, it's not an argument with the federal government about how they're going to start writing checks. It's about how do we as a whole society realize that to repair this vicious dehumanizing injustice, which is the history of extractive things, the history of genocide, murder, theft, rape, kidnapping, enslavement, that the repair to that goes into facilitating people being able to express their full humanity by being able to be fully productive and produce for themselves their own human needs and elevate the quality of life. So with that, I'll stop.
Ed Whitfield, before that, Gar Alpovitz, who can vision and envision that a new system is possible, both of whom are working on various forms of cooperative economic development. And I absolutely love to listen to them, and we're going to spend a lot more time in the next weeks bringing you people like Ed Whitfield, some of our sisters and brothers who really are implementing ways of responding to those who are disenfranchised and those who feel disenchanted with our economic system.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.